Good morning. It's Wade's World. You know what that means. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time. Wade's World, we're broadcasting from KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, Arkansas, 90.3 WAMF in New Orleans. In Wade's World, we talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today, we're talking to Pat McCoy. We're in Charlotte, North Carolina. Pat is Executive Director of Action NC. Pat, welcome to Wade's World.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. What's Action NC?
We are an organization that's been working in North Carolina for 5 years. We grew up out of, in terms of staff and leadership, what had been North Carolina Acorn. We got underway in the spring of 2010. And have, for the last 5 years, been pursuing a similar kind of organizing work, mostly in lower wealth communities with lower income constituencies, organizing around a variety of issues of concern to serve low and working income families, education, health care access, immigrant rights, voting rights, affordable housing, tenant rights, a long list of
the
things that
menu.
We stay busy doing.
Exactly. Yeah. But it looks like you've done a lot on the immigration and Latino community side. That's been a new chapter that you've expanded pretty dramatically over the last 5 years, from what I gathered from our conversations.
Well, we were doing good tenant organizing work among undocumented folks as Acorn, and we wanted to keep all of that going, both for the purposes of building a base through tenant work, which is one of the easier ways to reach people in a circumstance where they are very eager to get organized and get something handled about some problems they're dealing with every day that they shouldn't be. And we also saw that as a way to roll people over into immigrant rights work. Comprehensive immigration reform was expected to come up on the political agenda in 2010. It never did, but we wanted to be mobilizing for that. We had a guy I've been organizing for several years with us who was bilingual, who was eager to get out and sort of do that basic organizing work, knock on doors, really make those kind of contacts
God's
in an old
work.
School
yes,
way.
Yes, indeed.
So we saw an opportunity there, and there are immigrant groups here in Charlotte that provide services, but nobody at that time really organizing people, mobilizing them in a more political way. There was a lot of opportunity, a very huge growth here in Charlotte and all throughout North Carolina. I guess we were the second highest state in the 2010 census in terms of the growth of the immigrant community, and a lot of undocumented people had poured into Charlotte since the economy was booming, and they'd never been organized in the states before, and they had a lot of issues, a lot of things they were up against, like sort of community police relations that they were eager to talk to us about and take some action on. And that work has been a lot of fun and good for us. It's really a constituency that sticks together.
I'll bet. And were landlords particularly exploiting immigrants, Latinos and others? Or?
Yeah, we're here on the east side of Charlotte, which is where we've done most of the organizing. And it actually was very interesting and surprising to us. A lot of these apartment complexes where people who either just can't quite get into public housing because of their income level or because of a lack of space, which is true here as it is
sure.
everywhere else, are living in these apartment buildings, which were built in the 60s and 70s. The infrastructure is totally deteriorated in many of these places. It's just a tough situation. Just code violations everywhere you look. Appliances don't work. Windows don't lock. A lot of problems outside with sort of crime issues that the police are not handling. We truly were shocked at the conditions we saw in places we're charging people $600 or $700 a month for an apartment that was just, you know, a piece of junk. It really
gotcha.
Was. And these whole complexes, this was an issue. So, you know, we can't begin to meet the demand here in East Charlotte, never mind other parts of the city, to organize tenants to get something done about these problems. The city's actually good about code enforcement, like many places are under-resourced.
So you do have a good sort of standard of habitability or code, it's just it's not enforced, or what's the...
Yeah, Charlotte does. And in fact, Charlotte sort of was early on there, and eventually sort of some better state laws around tenant rights were passed, incorporating the Charlotte law, basically wholesale, into the state law. So we were out front there. But at the same time, in these older complexes, you know, owners, you can't find them. There's some address in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, of the ownership group. The management doesn't even seem to know how to get in touch with these people. We just we found it very difficult in the beginning, never mind the fact that if it's a private place, unless there's Section 8 people in there, you don't even have a right to go in there and organize. So we've often had to meet in restaurants,
down the street,
those kinds of situations. But Hector, our guy who has done that, it's, you know, we've turned up sort of 100 people within 2 days to march on the management's office. We've won a lot of good stuff out of that. We've also worked in some mobile home parks here. That is sort of the home ownership option for undocumented people. It's something they can afford. It's something they can get access to because they get the loans directly from the people who own the properties. A lot of bad practices.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of predatory stuff. But we've won some nice victories.
Is that more in the counties and outside the city limits, or is it still in the city limits? I don't know if I can understand the Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
Well, it surprised us. There's a fair bit of it in the city, and it's tucked into these parts of the city where you don't even see these mobile home communities.
That may be the secret for why they're there.
Yeah, right? Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, again, everybody, they're undocumented, easily exploited, as is true in the tenant situation. One thing we found that was really just seems to be very prevalent are illegal billing practices, either on sort of the mortgage payments. You know, people own the unit that they're living in. They don't own the ground beneath it. There's a lot of opportunity for mischief there, and they don't have nearly as many rights, even though rights are few for any tenant in North Carolina, but they're even fewer for people in these mobile home ownership situations. And a lot of illegal water billing practices.
I was going to ask about the utilities, because in the West, in Montana and at those areas, a lot of issues around utilities connected to land rent with trailers.
They sort of require people to pay both at once, even though the state law does not allow that. People don't get to see their bills. They're paid on a percentage basis. Folks have no way of knowing if, in fact, they're being fairly charged. And we've gotten big rebates from the Utilities Commission for a couple of those
contracts. That's an issue in Arkansas where we're broadcasting as well.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. I mean,
there's a lot of trailer homes, God knows. I mean, that's an affordable housing unit still.
And again, for the undocumented community, this is where they can actually get some foothold into home ownership here in North Carolina.
I have not been in Charlotte for, I don't know, 8 to 10 years. Wow, this city is growing, isn't it?
Projected to grow by 30% in the next 15 years, in spite of the fact that the unemployment rate skyrocketed during the financial crisis, because second largest banking center in the country, you know, huge layoffs at Bank of America, at what was then Wachovia, which sort of basically imploded and was taken over by Wells Fargo. So a very heavy hit in the local economy, but has roared back, and just the construction is everywhere to be seen here. This is a boom town.
And 30% growth would put the city over a million, probably, wouldn't it, or close to it?
Yeah, 700,000 now, so I think it projected a million by 2030.
Unbelievable, because that's, before you know it, 15, 16 years, really, 15 years, I guess. So, and that's obviously part of why you're seeing so many people coming in the community. Obviously, jobs must be in construction very big, and that's been an attractor for Latino communities particularly, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the growth, in Charlotte and in the Triangle area, the number of people, immigrants who poured in the last decade looking for work, hearing there were lots of jobs, and there were huge. And other than in the agricultural sector, which is more people who come back and forth, that's where the real growth has been here in North Carolina over the last 15 years.
Because obviously you used to think of North Carolina as manufacturing, textiles, lower wage furniture production. A lot of that just doesn't exist anymore.
Hardly at all. Yeah, it's service sector. It's, the healthcare systems, I mean, the big employers these days, those are the ones where
Research
people are getting
Research Triangle
jobs.
And just that and the other. Yeah. But, of course, this is a battleground state, I guess, and will be again in 2016. Certainly it has been 2012, 2008. What does it feel like to live in at least a purple state? I know you're not totally red and certainly not totally blue, but what's the political scene here now, Pat?
Well, you know, obviously, we're very happy in 2008, although it is important for people to recognize that Obama in 2008 lost in every demographic other than 18 to 30, which he won 73 to 27%.
in so North Carolina.
He won by 14,000 votes, and obviously all of that came from younger voters. And as we all know, sadly, younger voters don't turn out in midterm elections. We had some very, what we would consider to be pretty disastrous results in this last election cycle for that reason. We believe that with the right candidate on sort of the Democratic side, the base will turn out, but you know, we take nothing for granted at this point in terms of what it really takes to sort of get people motivated, even a big presidential election year. So, yeah, there are a good number of groups here in North Carolina that are working well, both on the C3-4 side and increasingly on the C4 side, to make sure that what we call the rising American electorate is touched in different ways during that campaign cycle and actually bothers to show up. But it's important to be a battleground state in the South. Otherwise, everybody's just whistling past you, right? So we are lucky in that way. People pay attention.
So millennials, but I think you're also targeting women, aren't you?
Yeah, we're working on a campaign. We call it Women Voting Our Values, targeting women who are within the rising American electorate, who are sort of infrequent voters, sort of really organizing issue-based campaigns around women's economic opportunity and security issues, pay equity, living wage, raising the minimum wage, family values at work, paid sick days, family medical leave, lifting those issues up to impress upon women the importance of making sure they're paying attention to the positions candidates are taking on these issues. Also, healthcare access, we're fighting the Medicaid expansion, something that a lot of women feel very strongly about, especially ones who have families, and also reproductive rights and reproductive justice. We tend to work in mostly communities of color, lower-income communities, so there's a lot of interest in taking the reproductive rights frame, which traditionally has been more around a narrow set of issues, and broadening it out in a way that it becomes more about sort of economic justice as well as reproductive justice itself.
We're talking to Pat McCoy, the executive director of Action NC. Formerly, he was selling us North Carolina Acorn, and we're in Charlotte, which is growing, but part of this fight, particularly on things like Medicaid expansion, is in Raleigh, the state capital, and Durham. You also work in other areas of North Carolina, don't you?
Yeah, we have. We organize on the ground in Charlotte and in Durham. We have an office in Raleigh as well, where we do more policy, legislative-oriented work, and would love to expand in other parts of the state as well. We actually, like a lot of parts of this country, we have this enormous urban-rural divide, where our cities are pretty blue. Some of them are actually surprisingly progressive to be in a formerly Confederate state. You know, we're in good shape in a lot of ways there, but we're still very evenly split, 50-50. And in a lot of these sort of smaller cities around the state, we don't have a big tradition in North Carolina of grassroots political organizing. I think largely because labor has always been, we've had the lowest labor density in the country ever since the BLS started to keep these statistics. So there's just not a lot going on there to sort of fuel that kind of community labor activism, which traditionally has been an important part, not only of turning people out on election day, but about shaping people's values. When you look in states where there is good union membership, even among the more conservative white electorate, at least by 10 or 15 percentage points, they vote in a better way because they're hearing a message from trusted sources. And it's more of a challenge for us to get that out here.
The when you talk about the labor movement and its weakness, that hurts in a lot of ways, but you've actually been partnering, I believe you told me, on a lot of the Fight for 15 and some of the push around raising wages, particularly for service sector workers, haven't you?
Yeah, and they've put up a very spirited, good campaign, and we're very happy to be sort of community partners, helping them put together events here in Charlotte and over in the Triangle. They've connected very well with the Moral Mondays Forward Together movement, the Reverend Barber, the NAACP.
Let's talk about that, because we've talked about it before on Wage World. Well, what's happening with the Moral Mondays? Are they still active?
It's about to begin again next week. In the wake of the 2013 protest, where almost 1,000 people were arrested doing civil disobedience of the legislature, the laws have been changed now to where that kind of assembly for which many of us were previously arrested is now legal. So they've been thinking about what is the strategy that's sufficiently hard-hitting and disruptive that we can push this forward. It's not like the legislature has changed.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's still way far right. And, you know, as we speak, every day they're cooking up new bad stuff There's a brand new bill that's just got passed in the House today about sort of restricting abortion rights even further. And there's just, I mean, it's a very, very long list. So we need to be pushing back. It's been an effective, especially messaging movement to sort of point out how extremist many of these policies have been, how the state, a traditionally very moderate state politically, and the most so of any in the South, has been hijacked by these conservative forces, and how it's important we sort of push back and take it back. And I think that movement really has sort of created another political narrative here in the state, which has really helped slow the legislature down in some ways in terms of at least the kind of rhetoric they use. Although it's not necessarily slowing them down in terms of passing dreadful legislation. So
and what tactic were you doing that they did have you as illegal and now they say is legal? What were you doing actually, specifically?
There were big rallies outside with several thousand people. This went on for 13 weeks in 2013, which was what we call the long session. And a lot of the really bad stuff that's happened in North Carolina in the wake of the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the horrible redistricting we've had to deal with that affected the 2012 election and we'll be having to live with in a very painful way up until 2020. A lot of that stuff was rolling out in 2013. This is ALEC-sponsored legislation, model stuff that has been sweeping the country on voting rights, voter suppression, unemployment benefits, Medicaid expansion, the whole list.
ALEC is a big Koch brothers vehicle, or funded vehicle that we've talked about. American Legislative Exchange Council,
I believe it's called.
You know, whatever. I'm not sure, but they have these bills in Arkansas and Louisiana, Texas, North Carolina, all of our states, and they're very regressive.
Yeah, they're very right wing, and we knew it was coming, so. Even before the legislative session began, all the sort of progressive groups in the state were talking about what can we do about this. And Reverend Barber put this coalition together, really going back to 2006. It's called HK on J, and mobilized every year in February to in front of the legislative building. And the thinking was, okay, this year we need to do something even much bigger and better. So this whole civil disobedience strategy was put together, started, I think, in late April. Went until the session ended at the end of July, but people would go into the rotunda, the legislature, and would sing and chant and be disruptive, and we'd get three warnings from the police, and on the third, folks were arrested, and in the end, all the cases were dismissed because it clearly should have been protected First Amendment activity, just what people should be able to do in the people's house. And now the legislators recognize that and perhaps also thinking, okay, one of the ways to deal with this unruly crowd of people is to sort of no longer arrest them for it in the first place. So.
I know one of the shocks as a young organizer when we used to be able to move some mayors by sitting in their office and demanding jobs for youth or whatever was, we did an action in New Orleans and sat in, I must have been close to 100 people sat in on Mayor Dutch Morial's office in New Orleans. And then you knew that the tactics were changing when all of a sudden he told the secretaries, well, bring in some cookies and Cokes, and he walked out and left us there. So there we were sitting in his office. He was gone. You know, we had Cokes and cookies, and it started to get to be night a couple hours later, and you know, that we'd lost some of the edge on that action. So y'all are going to come up with something different then on, was it Moral Mondays? I thought you mentioned something on Wednesdays now.
Witness Wednesday will be the first event next week, and there's a conference call on Friday night to talk about what the strategy is going to be, I think, not just for Wednesday, but going forward. All I know is on the message, which is widely distributed, get on the call, please, if you're particularly interested in civil disobedience. So
it'll be civil disobedience. Well, and this is something that North Carolina has showed some leadership on, and Reverend Barber, I know he's popped up in Arkansas and Georgia. They had something similar. And he's been speaking around the country. So had he been active, you say, since
2006, I think he became the head of the NAACP in 2005 and immediately saw the importance of knitting progressive groups together. So they put together a 14-point platform agenda and sort of got environmental groups, civil rights groups, community groups, advocacy groups on a whole range of different issues together and said,
well,
let's build a progressive coalition.
I mean, those are hard coalitions to put together. So Maybe, you know, there'll be some leadership on that again. We'll have to all, we may have to get everybody back together on another Wage World and talk about what y'all come up with next. We're talking to Pat McCoy, Executive Director of Action NC. What are other big issues that y'all are involved in here in North Carolina that might be leading the way in the South as well? We talked about Medicaid expansion. Any hope at all here? Or?
Yeah, we believe that our governor, like a lot of Republican governors, is not as conservative on this issue as he has been sounding in the wake of the whole Tea Party revolt from 2009 forward. We know the Hospital Association, some pretty powerful players, are saying, look, we really need this to make things add up for us. So we think it could get done. At the same time, the legislative stranglehold of that Tea Party faction is such that they ain't having it, they're not hearing about it, and it's just not clear where it's going to go. But that's one of our highest priority issues, for obvious reasons, an important part of making the health care reform we thought we had won in the first place actually happen here in North Carolina, affect up to 500,000 people in the state. So,
and that's a lot of people, and clearly we did see some good news out of Montana recently. They did expand it, but Tennessee, our neighboring state between North Carolina and Arkansas, the governor's a good example of what you were just talking about, Pat. He's supposedly been negotiating various exemptions and whatever for 18 months, almost 2 years with the Obama administration, and then couldn't even get it out of committee in a Republican Party vote on his own committee in the legislature in Nashville. Boom, no expansion.
Yeah, although you look at Pennsylvania, you look at Ohio, you look at, what is, I think, Iowa's another state. There, you know, there had been Michigan.
Arizona.
Yeah, states where you didn't think it was going to happen, and the governors had sort of sounded as anti-Obamacare as anybody else, finally just saw that it's too generous a deal, and if we can ensure this many of our citizens here in the state and give them health care and sort of help out these beleaguered institutions that are on the hook to take them into their emergency rooms when they don't have insurance, it just doesn't make sense not to do it.
And hospitals seem to be one of the major employers now in North Carolina. You were mentioning that in terms of the expansion of the state's growth sectors, but
huge, yes, especially in the big urban areas.
They've got to be feeling the punch here and disproportionate care. I mean, they're going to be cutting that down. Disproportionate care is obviously that part of the additional money from Medicaid that you receive as a hospital if you have a disproportionate share of low-income clients. And not having changed and expanded Medicaid, it was expected that those payments would go down originally before the Supreme Court decision. So there's less budgeted. So that's something we see this as an issue in Florida where the governor's, you know, acting like a, you know, crying like a stuck pig because he's got a $1 billion shortfall in disproportionate care, but hasn't expanded, and even has Republicans claiming, hey, you got to do something. So that bill's coming due pretty soon.
And they're all feeling the squeeze, but especially in rural areas. We've had hospital closing in rural areas. We have ones that are just hanging on by a thread now. And the legislature's making all this noise about how we need to redistribute money. They've actually come up with a new sales tax distribution formula to take money away from cities, put it to rural areas, saying they're being unfairly disadvantaged by the current scheme. It's going to hurt cities like Charlotte and Durham and Raleigh, where we organize. And it's not a good idea, but at the same time, we all want more development in rural areas. But the big employers, never mind the health care providers or these rural hospitals, and without Medicaid expansion, they're just not going to make it. So the legislature is in a bit of a bind there because there's a fundamental contradiction. It's like what they say on taxes, right? It'll generate more revenue. It never does. So then they start imposing all these fees, which they're doing here in North Carolina now, just not to call them tax, but to make up for the revenue shortfall, which has to be dealt with. So that's the level of sort of political discourse we're dealing with from this crowd. But
Gotcha. Again,
there's been some good pushback, and we've slowed them down some.
I gathered talking to you about longer-term political strategy. Battleground counties are going to be these northeast and is it southeast counties that if they start to move a little pinker, a little more blue or whatever, there's more hope that the majorities could be affected in the legislature as well? Or
it's critical in the legislature. You know, if we can move enough of base in the big urban areas, we can win on the big national elections. Whether or not that happens remains to be seen. We were the only battleground state that Romney carried in 2012.
Right.
He lost 10, but he won this one by a little bit more than one percentage point. So we've got our work cut out for us there. You know, but in these sort of more rural counties, especially ones that have cities where our constituency lives, we really need to be sort of deploying progressive forces out to those parts of the state if we're going to flip the legislature before 2020. And we're not sure we can make it to 2020 unless
gotcha.
We do flip this crowd.
Yeah.
So we really need to be out there looking at sort of districts which can be swung and putting resources, you know, really playing the ground game in those areas. That's what will make the difference.
Now, is population increasing throughout the state, or is it mainly just in the urban areas?
Primarily in the urban areas, although we're not being quite as rapidly depopulated in the rural areas as some other parts of the South. But yeah, the real growth is in Charlotte, it's in the Triangle areas, in the Triad area, Greensboro and Winston-Salem.
Big news in New Orleans, where WAMF, one of our broadcast stations, is located. You can't go smoke in bars anymore. Now, this used to be tobacco land. You still see people smoking on the street, but tobacco must be a hugely diminished rural crop here.
Oh yeah, that's all somewhere else now. It's not in North Carolina. There's still some in the eastern part of the state, but it's just a fraction of what it used to be. And I think that's true for virtually every agricultural product in the state now.
So cotton.
Cotton, well,
tobacco, the whole nine.
Corn and soybeans, you know, sort of the agribusiness products.
Right.
I shouldn't say that they're diminished because I think that is not the case.
But gotcha.
Their traditional cash crops are sort of not what they used to be, or even, again, a fraction of it.
So. Gotcha. Now, is traditionally the more mountainous parts of the state more Republican or more Democrat? Asheville and those areas.
Well, Asheville is very urban at this point. Popular retirement center. People coming in from all over the country.
People from everywhere.
But the mountains historically, and Charlotte as well, traditionally, sort of from Charlotte west was a Republican part of the state. And sort of most parts east of there were, the reason North Carolina was so solidly Democratic was